Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 2705, Compaq Computer Corporation against LePray. Chief Justice Phillips is recused.
May I please report, this is David Beck, representing argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The trial court in our case certified a nationwide B2 class and a nationwide B4 class. The Beaumont Court of Appeals affirmed that order in its entirety. We urge this court to prevent the respondents, the plaintiffs below, from circumventing what we believe is the teachings of this court, both in Bernal and in the Shine case.
Have we ever spoken as to whether predominance and superiority are required by B2?
You have not, Your Honor. But our position is, and we think the federal cases support it, that because of the very nature of a B2 class, it assumes a cohesive group, it assumes a homogeneity of interest, and it assumes a harm which will be suffered by the class as a whole. So basically, we say that that's implicit in the whole B2 class. But the Anti-Competitive Court has not expressly addressed that issue squarely.
So this will be a matter of first impression?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, then how can we have a conflict for jurisdictional purposes?
Well, because we think that if you look at what the court did was certify two different classes, and you look at what the court...
Is that finding necessary to your conflicts argument, that there were two, that there was certification under B2 and B4?
Well, we think that if you look at what this court said in Bernal, that this court, the trial judge, for example, must perform a rigorous analysis. Well, we don't think that's limited to B4.
All right, let me narrow my question. If we were to find that the certification was solely under B2,
right,
and whether predominance and superiority is required is a matter of first impression, how would we get conflicts jurisdiction?
Well, for example, again, if the court looks at what you said in Bernal and what you said in Shine, for example, in Shine, you talk about choice of law, how important that is to a B4 analysis. The same analysis is applicable to B2, Your Honor, because when you start trying to decide such issues as whether there's a breach of warranty, whether the warranty is covered.
So you'd say conflict of law would be over choice of law. I mean, the conflict.
That's one of them. And there are other decisions that we've cited in our brief where we say that there is a direct conflict with what the courts of this state are saying. A more recent example is the Houston Court of Appeals in a case that we sent to the court yesterday. Talked about this whole issue of claim splitting. Talked about this whole issue of res judicata.
But
which is fundamentally inconsistent with what the Beaumont Court of Appeals did.
But it would not be a conflict based on predominance and superiority, presuming the predicates to my prior question.
It would not be a conflict based solely on predominance and superiority if you're of the view that that's not implicit in the B2 analysis to begin with. Our position is it is implicit in this analysis by the very nature of a B2 class. And the cases we've cited from the federal court say essentially that.
And as far as the conflict of laws piece, if the trial court thoroughly analyzed the law and found, be it correctly or incorrectly for conflicts purposes, that the law was fairly uniform throughout the nation, then there would not be a conflict there as long as it was thoroughly analyzed.
Well, I respectfully disagree with Your Honor. First of all, there's no evidence about what the court actually did. The court said it did an analysis. We don't know what the analysis was. We don't know how the court did an analysis. The court said it did an analysis and came to the conclusion that there was really no conflict. If the court looks at the cases that we submitted, the court will see that let me mention just two instances. This whole concept of an unmanifested defect, which is at the heart of this lawsuit, or one of the issues is at the heart of this lawsuit, you've got cases from other states that say that there is no cause of action for breach of warranty for an unmanifested defect. Well, the Beaumont Court of Appeals dealt with our pointing out the differences and the conflicts in various state laws by simply saying that number one, we didn't point out the conflict, which is incorrect, and then secondly, that all the cases we cited were federal cases. That is patently incorrect. We cited case after case after case. True, some of the cases were federal cases, but they applied state law. The Bridgestone case, Judge Easterbrook's excellent opinion, he talked about Indiana law and Tennessee law. So the Beaumont Court of Appeals was clearly wrong when it said that somehow we didn't point out the conflicts. Notice is another one, Your Honor. Under the UCC, there's a Beaumont Court of Appeals case, excuse me, Houston Court of Appeals case, which we cited, which specifically talks about how the filing of a lawsuit is not notice under the UCC.
Why wouldn't LePray's letter in 1999 to Compaq on behalf of the uncertified class?
Well, LePray's letter was after the lawsuit was filed. In other words, he's already filed a lawsuit, and what we have, Your Honor, is you have three plaintiffs posing as class representatives when they have different situations. We have one plaintiff, for example, who gave notice outside the one-year warranty period. That was Mr. Wilson. We had another of the class reps, Owens, sent a notice to Compaq, and when Compaq tried to respond to the notice, would not respond to the call. You had Mr. LePray, Justice Jefferson, which gave his notice, but after the lawsuit was filed. And then you had another one that downloaded the software patch, which we say cured the problem. They dispute that, and that's an issue between us. So you have different class representatives with different situations, which we say create fact issues. But to get back to your question, Your Honor, on the issue of notice, you've got Alaska, for example, that says the filing of notice, the filing of a lawsuit is notice. You've got other states that say, no, we need to take the notice issue on a case-by-case basis. Well, Your Honor, if the trial court, we respectfully submit, had done what we believe this court instructed in Bernal and also endorsed in Shine, the court would have done a more thorough analysis. We think the type of analysis the court should have done is the type of analysis that was actually done by the Houston Court of Appeals, the 14th Court, in Tracker Marine. And if the court will look at what the 14th Court of Appeals did in Tracker Marine, a very recent decision, which a petition's already been filed with this court, the Court of Appeals did an exhaustive analysis of the state laws and pointed out the conflicts on each of the various issues. That's what the trial court, we say, in our case, should have done.
Let me ask you, we have several amicus briefs that argue that the respondents don't have standing to litigate breach of warranty if there's no harm shown. Or you're making that same argument.
We did not specifically use the term standing, Your Honor. What we questioned was the typicality of these plaintiffs, and the position we've taken is if they really haven't suffered any harm, then really there should be no declaratory judgment action. There certainly should be no B2 class or B4 class. Because the warranty in this case is a limited warranty. What it does, it says that Compaq will provide a computer free from defects under normal use. So you get to the whole issue of what is normal use.
Just to focus it, can we render an opinion based on standing or not by virtue of the arguments you presented?
Your Honor, I think you can under the rubric of typicality. I think that if this court concludes, for example, that they have no defect in the case, or assume there's an unmanifested defect, then you get to the issue of, well, why are we even here? How can these people be typical of a class when there's no injury or no manifested injury at this point? And the reason that becomes important is let's assume we try this case. And let's assume the jury, and whether it's a B2 or B4, I'll speak to that in a moment, we try the case, and the jury finds no defect. And then you've got some unnamed class member on down the road who thinks that they've got a cause of action. Well, they're bound by this decision, certainly under the B2 class, because under our rules, and it's slightly different from the federal rules, under the state rules, we say that when the notice goes out, you tell the B2 class members that the decision and the judgment of the court is binding. They don't have that same provision in Rule 23, so there's a little bit of difference between our Rule 42 and the federal Rule 23.
Let me ask you, I'm not a computer whiz, but let's take an example. If you had a computer that was shipped nationwide without a floppy disk controller, it just got left out of the package. It was supposed to have one, but it just didn't get shipped. And it was warranted to have one, then would that be appropriate for a class action?
That would be a much closer question. It'd probably be similar to the Coghlan case, which I think both parties have talked about. That was the case, Your Honor, where the defendant said, we're going to sell you, I think it was an all-fiberglass hull, and it wasn't an all-fiberglass hull. In other words, it was an either-or situation. We don't have that in our case.
Well, but that you think that would be an appropriate B2 class then?
What would be, Your
Honor?
That
would be an appropriate B2 class if it was shipped without the floppy disk.
No, I do not, because it has. There are a lot of other issues involved, and let me speak to that directly. Remember, a B2 class doesn't use the term damages at all.
Another issue.
It says nothing about
right,
damages.
Another issue. All right. I'm just saying, if all I sought was to have them ship the floppy disk controller to me, that's it. Why would that not be an appropriate class?
Well, what else are you asking?
That's it.
That you're just simply asking for a declaratory judgment, for example, that somehow you didn't get what you asked
that,
for?
That Compact is to ship out the floppy disk controllers mm-hmm. to its customers.
Your Honor, I would respectfully say that still is not enough to justify a B2 class because it doesn't end the dispute between the parties. Supposing you get a declaratory judgment, the dispute is not over.
But why not?
Well, because even
that's
though
that's all I'm asking for.
But it's all you're asking for. But it doesn't resolve the fundamental dispute between the parties.
Why not?
Because you didn't get what you thought you were supposed to get. What happens after that? Is there a warranty involved? What does the warranty say?
My example is very simple. It's just, you know, we warrant that in this box is a floppy disk controller.
Right.
And I open it and there's not.
Right.
And no one else was sent a floppy disk controller.
Okay.
And I say, I want a declaratory judgment that Compact will send me a floppy disk controller as they promised was in the box. Why is that not a proper class?
I would say it's still not a proper class, although there may be one common issue involved.
Why is it not proper?
Well, it's not proper because if you're asking for a declaratory judgment that says you didn't get something, let's assume it's undisputed you didn't get it. What's the remedy?
A declaration and an order that Compact will ship.
All right,
it.
You get the declaration, but there's still another step here. Does that mean you get a new computer? Does that mean they somehow take the computer back, install the
floppy
disk controller?
Well, let me ask you, is there any class action you think could ever be appropriate?
Under B2?
Yes. Against a computer?
I can, Your Honor. I think the more difficult question is, can you ever have under Rule 42 a B2 class for damages or the functional equivalent?
Well, I'm taking out damages. I didn't mention damages in my example.
I think you could. Let's put damages aside. I think you could if you had, for example, similar to what's in the federal cases, where you have, say, a discrimination situation, where you have discrimination to a cohesive group, you've got a homogeneity of interest, and the harm is the same.
Why is my example not that case?
Because
the same group, they didn't get a part.
Right.
It's undisputed. They want a declaration that the company has to send me the part they promised to send me.
Okay.
They're the same. I don't want damages.
Well, but I think you need to take it one step further. I don't think it's enough to simply say, because basically what you're saying is that you didn't get the benefit of your bargain. That's really what you're saying. So that when you look at a claim for not getting the benefit of the bargain, you've got to ask yourself, for example, what all the components for that are. Clearly, you focused on a major component of the hypothetical that you gave us. But there are other elements of that, the elements being, what is your remedy? And it is not just the declaratory judgment. For example, in this case, the plaintiffs are asking for...
No, I'm just trying to get my hypothetical. I still don't understand why that would not be certifiable as a claim.
Basically, it's because, Your Honor, that it doesn't resolve the entire dispute
why
between
not?
The parties.
If all I want is a declaration and an order from the court,
right.
Send the floppy disk controller, why doesn't that resolve everything?
Well, it doesn't because you still have the issue of what the remedy is. Now, if you're saying that you want a declaratory judgment, that you didn't get the benefit of the bargain, and somehow, and I hesitate to introduce this, but when you're talking about the benefit of the bargain, you're talking about the whole bargain. You're just not talking about one little component.
No, I'm just talking about this box contains 1, 2, and 3. 3 is not in the box.
I understand.
I want 3. Give me an order saying you'll send me 3.
Well, again, Your Honor, I can only say that that doesn't resolve the entire controversy. We respectfully submit.
Mr. Beck, there have been a lot of back and forth about the state of the record here. And can you tell us whether we have everything we need to review?
We think you do, Your Honor. We think you have everything in the record that you need at this point. I think eventually counsel worked together and got the complete record from Your Honor.
On your adequacy argument, what claims do you think may be given up by class members that are not precluded by the express warranty?
Well, we know that they initially claimed breach of implied warranty. We know they initially claimed and dropped revocation of acceptance. We know they initially sought and dropped a request for injunction. We also know, and this is in the record, that they also filed, the same class counsel filed, a breach of implied warranty in another courtroom on behalf of these same class members. So the issue is that if you drop the implied warranty claim in our case and reassert it in another case, either it had value or it didn't have value.
But I assume you think it doesn't.
Well, they think it does. More importantly, well, they think it does. Their position is, as I understand it, that somehow that entitles the warranty period to be extended and it has other value. So the question is, well, if they truly believe it has value, then why was it dropped in this case? And that's why, Your Honor, we say and we urge this court to adopt a rule which makes clear that whenever you have claim splitting or claim dropping, that this court adopt a bright-line test to assist our trial courts in making that determination. Now, whether that means a rigorous analysis to make sure that when there is claim dropping, that you expressly, the trial court must analyze what the, you know, what that claim is, the value of the claim, why it was dropped, and so on, because it has res judicata consequences, particularly in a B2 class where you can't opt out.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Gary Rieger, present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. When Compaq gave this formal product warranty, it deliberately elected to take advantage of a safe harbor under Section 2719 of the Uniform Commercial Code. That safe harbor allows Compaq to protect itself against the unknown risk of open-ended damages. But to obtain that safe harbor, Compaq had to agree in writing to repair and replace defective parts.
Is it true, though, that the harbor has different contours and depths in different jurisdictions?
That safe harbor does not, as applied to our case, because of another provision that Compaq took advantage of. If all they did was stop at repair or replace the part, there might be a question of whether that safe harbor failed of its essential purpose. Compaq twisted the screw one notch more and gave what the commentators call a backup remedy of refund, and the law is universal that if the repair and replacement warranty has a backup remedy of refund or unit replacement, that it cannot fail of its essential purpose. Compaq actually, and the record supports.
Do you think that there are not individual differences in substantive law that would apply if you applied the law of the jurisdiction in which the class member resided?
Yes, I believe that's correct. There's not. Compaq actually, and the record supports this, included an extra cost increment in the price of the computer for this warranty. So we see the question as whether B2 can be used for the simple and limited purpose of enforcing those limited rights and remedies that every class member paid for when the warranty's the same, the effect is the same. The remedies are the same.
You're not clear in the brief whether you think there should be opt-outs.
That is actually premature, but I will address it because the trial court did not say there would or wouldn't be opt-outs. I believe the Fifth Circuit in the recent Monumental Life opinion addressed that question appropriately, that is something the trial court should evaluate after certification, and that certainly the trial court would have the authority to issue opt-out. Texas actually has a super opt-out that's different than that applies to B2.
Well, if you've got opt-outs, it's starting to look a lot like a B4 class.
Well, it is starting to look a lot like B4 class, and
what's the difference?
Well, far from running from B4, we asked for certification under B4 and got it, and the only reason we think it wasn't affirmed by the Court of Appeals is they didn't think they had to do it twice. They affirmed under B2. We don't know whether opt-out at this point should or shouldn't be appropriate. That's for the trial court to decide.
If it is,
yes, sir.
What's the difference between the B2 and the B4 class in your case?
If the class had opt-out rights, the difference under Texas law would be different than in the federal, because the federal law would make the judgment binding on every B2 class member.
Well,
they opted out, or even if they didn't, even those who didn't opt out and didn't get notice of it, still be binding.
Yes, but if you got, but their Rule C doesn't require notice. Our Rule C does require notice.
Right.
But you might or might not have an opt out under B2 and under either rule, right?
That's right.
And if you do, then how is that any different from a B4 class?
Two ways under the Texas rule. The Texas rule says that a B2 judgment is not binding unless the class member actually received the notice. So those who didn't receive notice would not be bound under the Texas rule. Secondly, B2, unlike the federal rule, gives every B2 class member...
But would that be the case if you could opt out?
Well, what it does is it protects B2 class members who never know they need to opt out. The second difference with the Texas rule, is also 42C, is that after the certification, after the notice, the Texas rule allows the B2 class members, not B4, but B2 class members to appear and challenge adequacy and challenge the class, which allows them a more direct role in challenging adequacy in the class, and with the flexibility given the trial court, they could even convince the trial court to carve out subclasses or not by the class. So that's the two basic ways that B2 and B4 would differ in Texas.
But you did not take a position at the trial court about whether it should be opt-out or not?
No, we have not.
Do you have a position yet?
No, Your Honor, I'm trying to get through today.
Yeah, right.
How many people are in your class?
There are about 1.8 million in the class.
Does that assume opt-out or not?
That's all the potential in the class,
so that
whether they opt-out or not.
So that presumes or assumes for purposes of calculating your number that none opt out.
That's right.
There's a provision that excludes judges. I don't have the language in front of me from being in the class. What is that about?
That's about making sure that as the class is litigated that you do not end up where you cannot have any judges either trying the case or presiding over the case. For instance, when Compaq first filed their flurry of motions in federal court, they filed a motion to disqualify every judge in the Eastern District on the basis that the district clerk owned a Compaq computer. And so that's becoming sort of a standard clause in class certifications to make sure that you end up with a judiciary that can decide the issue.
Well, doesn't that create a due process problem for judges who might want to make that call themselves? And the judges already have an independent obligation to consider recusal issues on their own.
Well, Your Honor, then you would have the right under the Texas rule to appear and challenge adequacy or the class on that basis. And if an opt-out was given, you would have the right to opt out.
In this Title IV title case, the U.S. Supreme Court noted the existence of at least a substantial possibility that actions seeking money damages are certifiable under the federal rule 23B2, which is B4. Why should we certify classes under B2 in light of that?
If there is damages in the class, yes. Which we say there are not, but I answer your question. Obviously, the Supreme Court had not made a decision on that proposition. And subsequent to TICOR, all the federal jurisdictions, including the Fifth Circuit as recently as this summer, have permitted, based on the official comments to the 1966 Advisory Committee, that damages are allowed to be two classes as long as they do not predominate.
And let me ask another question. You say you get the B2 class on the basis of Compaq's breaching and express warranty. And wouldn't any breach of contract action be certifiable under that point of view, even if damages are sought in B2 class?
No, Your Honor, because although the term breach is thrown out maybe by both sides a little loosely, actually what this class seeks to do is to enforce the warranty. And in the bench book we provided the court, I believe it's tab 5, we show that it's the terms of the warranty in Compaq's position that makes this case different. Compaq says that, and admits and pled to the trial court, that what we have here is a dispute over the interpretation of the warranty. And we cannot be called to the dock for failing to repair or replace until that dispute is resolved. And here's another key linchpin, at the same time, they stand on their exclusion of remedies in their warranty. The terms of their warranty have forced Compaq and have forced the plaintiffs to the point where this case is limited to, can there be a declaration that will allow the class to get what was warranted, which was a computer free of defects and material.
Do you think that the requirements of the B4 class of predominance and superiority are essentially incorporated in the B2 ideas of cohesiveness and homogeneity?
I would put it differently, because obviously the drafters must have intended some difference. I would say that every B2 class, I know our B2 class, that can satisfy the requirements of B2 would also satisfy the requirements of B4. In fact, I believe the Ninth Court imposed stricter requirements on this class, stricter degree of cohesiveness, than it would have if it had reached the B4 criteria.
Well, why is it important to you that it be one or the other?
Well, Your Honor, it's important to me, to be candid about it, is because I'm up here supporting a B2 class. To the actual class members, it makes no difference whether it's certified under B2 or B4. To this court, and maybe to defendants generally, B2 is the more restrictive way to affirm this class than B4. And if the court is looking for a way to affirm this class on the narrowest ground, a B2 is the narrowest ground. Because as the Fifth Circuit pointed out, and I believe it's tab 7, the limited relief available in the B2 class self-contains how far B2 can go. Because there's not going to be that many class members who are satisfied simply with the type of limited damages and relief available in the B2 class.
And let me ask you about that. If this were just a single plaintiff, could that plaintiff bring just a declaratory judgment action rather than a suit for enforcement or breach of the warrant?
Yes, he could. In fact, I'm afraid if he brought just a breach of warranty claim, he would lose on summary judgment because of the terms of the warranty.
explain that, because they haven't breached the judges.
Oh, I thought you said that they would have breached it. Yes, yes, it could. You're assuming.
I'm just saying, if this weren't a class, could you bring a declaratory judgment action?
Yes, you could.
Why wouldn't you be required to bring an action for breach of the warranty or damages or some sort of enforcement? Not just a statement, yes, indeed, there is this warranty.
Why would we be required to do
yes.
this? Because the warranty excludes not only the remedy of damages, but if you read it, which is tab three, you will see it excludes all causes of action. And we cite in tab five to the record where they're pleading before the trial court, where they say they sued for refund, that's barred. They sued for repair and replacement, that's barred. Everything we sued for, they said, is barred in the form of a breach of warranty cause of action. The only thing we have left, due to the skillful compact lawyers who drew this warranty many years ago, is this declaratory judgment.
Can you address the conflict, our jurisdiction?
Ma'am?
Can you address our jurisdiction to decide these questions? Specifically, there's the rigorous analysis of predominance and superiority, which we don't know whether that applies to B2 or not at this point, I suppose, because it's a matter of first impression. But in terms of conducting a rigorous analysis of conflict of laws, the trial court's order says that the plaintiffs have provided a thorough and comprehensive survey. There were experts, there were graphs, there were charts. Do we have that in our record?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. And the choice of law record is over 3,700 pages long, but it includes many shorter summaries by noted experts, theirs and ours, as well as analysis by counsel, that is useful. And if I could address that, Your Honor, because there's a natural degree of skepticism, should be, when I said the law is uniform. We go back to the fact that Compaq gave a formal product warranty. Under 719, the whole purpose of 719, which is uniform among all the states, is to facilitate commerce. It allows a seller the privilege of packaging his liability and his remedies within the four corners of a warranty and hoisting himself above the vagaries of the different states so that he can conduct business on a nationwide basis and know that in Alaska he warranted the same thing he warranted in Florida. And when you analyze the cases, when you're talking about enforcing a 2719 warranty, there is complete uniformity.
Is there complete uniformity on the question whether potential harm is actionable? When the FTC didn't do any damage whatsoever, do all states agree that you can sue and bring class action for that?
I'll come back to it. I disagree it didn't cause any damage at all, but there is complete uniformity that what is warranted will be enforced. It depends on what's warranted. For instance, in Firestone, the warranty that Firestone gave is not a warranty free from defects. Firestone warranty is a tire will remain usable for so many miles, and I think that brief is in the record that shows that. Our warranty warrants against defective parts, so all you have to do is prove the defective part. Justice Jefferson, would be like if they warranted to you that your car is going to be red. You wouldn't have to prove personal injury. It depends on what's warranted. So what we have to prove is their expert, Professor Anderson, put it, when you have a written warranty, formal warranty, and it's against defects, you prove the defect by proving the defect. That's what we have to prove in this case. And that's the manifestation under the formal warranty. And that not a single case, as long as the list as they can make it, and as much paper as they can fill, they have not identified a single case that disqualifies a claim to enforce a formal warranty requiring personal injury or other manifestation of the like.
If a repair could fix it, is that an individualized determination? In other words, I understand y'all are disputing whether the patch is a universal fix. If would that dissolve into individual claims as to whether the patch could fix a particular computer or not, or is that more of a global determination?
That's another way this court could restrict this decision, because I conceive of a case where it would be an individual issue. In our case, we actually have depositions of their corporate representatives, and they were asked what the methods of repair and replacement are. This is a T90 chip. You can't actually get in. There's a missing part in it. You can't get in with tools and put the part back in. So their own corporate representative said that if pushed to a hardware repair, they would repair it by inserting a $5 board. And so we have complete uniformity in the method of repair in this particular instance. Now, if you have a case involving a house, maybe there's six ways to fix a roof, but they're not six ways to fix this chip.
What are the claims that your clients have disclaimed? Consequential damages, I understand.
We never sued for consequential damages. We dropped claim for implied warranty. We dropped the claim for repair.
Back to consequential damages. You say we've never sued for consequential damages.
It was not dropped. It wasn't disclaimed. It was just never, there was never a count or a prayer for consequential damages.
So do you believe members of the class could later sue for consequential damages?
I do, Your Honor. But I also, if I can develop that a little bit, because as a matter of fact, beyond the racial equality issue, the trial court analyzed the reasons for not pursuing consequential damages and found we were justified not doing so. But under normal rules of res judicata and the United States Supreme Court decision in Cooper versus Federal Reserve, we do not believe if there were any consequential damages that they would be barred. We also have a representation of Compaq that there are no pending claims for consequential damages to be cut off. And the case has been pending since 1999. If you indulge me just maybe 30 seconds or a minute, I have to do it speedily, but I can give you the res judicata analysis under this court's own opinions.
Well, let me ask it this way. If members of the class obtain their relief under the declaratory judgment claim, then later sue for consequential damages, let's assume those who sue for consequential damages are the ones who opted out. Would any fact findings be res judicata as to them? And then analyze that with regard to the ones who didn't opt out.
No, Your Honor, it's very similar to, it's because there is a spatial difference between the claim for consequential damages and our claim. It's like in Cooper, the United States Supreme Court said that a pattern and practice discrimination class did not bar a subsequent claim for individual discrimination by a class member. The same reasoning applies here. We've got to prove this FTC is defective in the box in normal use, that is, general. That has nothing to do, whether we win or lose that, will have nothing to do with whether a particular individual can claim that in a particular instance, that floppy disk controller failed and caused particular consequential damages. If they find that it's not defective in normal use and they win, a class member who can prove, well, maybe it's not defective in normal use, but it was defective in my use, he would not be barred.
So would it be here? Go ahead and answer that one. Then I have another one.
Why is it?
Well, under the analysis of Cooper, two reasons. One is that the operative fact that are determined in a pattern and practice situation or in a normal use situation just doesn't determine one way or the other whether a particular instance was caused by a defect. And this court's analysis also, Your Honor, there's another element that's important in the res judicata. Classes aside, the typical transactional test from the very beginning, this court has held that even claims rising out of the same transaction will not be barred if there is some procedural reason preventing full adjudication. In the Van Dyke case, the court said a necessary corollary to the transactional rule is if a claim is severed, it cannot be barred because it couldn't be tried. In Getty Oil, this court held that a claim that rose out of the same transaction was not barred because Getty Oil was prevented from bringing it because of a no-action provision in its contract, and Rule 38 prevented joinder. And in Rapid American, this court held that a disease arising out of the same exposure couldn't be fully litigated. Here, absent class members are by definition, you can't join them, by definition. Under our rules, they have no standing to conduct discovery as parties. And in Cooper, as Cooper pointed out, when the trial court says he's not going to try something in the class, it can't be tried. It's the equivalent of severance. So under normal res judicata rules, even if there was an instance of res judicata, which I don't believe constitutes were, but if it was, it would not be barred.
So is it fair to say that you fully expect, even if a class is certified for the declaratory judgment, that some, perhaps much, litigation would continue over these same controllers?
No, I do not, because, as I said, the compact is represented, and it's in the evidence, what other floppy disk controller disputes there are. And they have represented there's not a single claim where anyone is making a claim for consequential damages for the floppy disk controller.
And you think that precludes plaintiffs from bringing suits later?
I don't think it precludes them in the sense of a legal preclusion. If they hadn't brought them already, they'd probably barred by limitation.
So if there is no consequential damage from this, what's the, you mentioned before that there is harm done even in instances where no harm is shown. What is the harm?
The harm is, and I want to, I hate to get too technical, but I think it's important for me to just to address. It's hard to visualize something that's microscopic as missing a hardware part. This chip is missing. If you could blow it up, you could identify what it's missing. It's missing a part that universal industry standards require. And as the memo from Compaq, which is in the record, said, when they decided to ship this anyway, they said, when it happens, by its nature, it's silent. You don't know what happened. And in the words of the Compaq corporate representative explaining that memo, the user won't blame us, it will blame a bad floppy diskette. The problem is it is so microscopic and silent that it would be difficult, if not impossible, because it leaves no traceable signature to ever say with confidence that a particular instance of data corruption was caused by this particular floppy disk controller, but it can be proven statistically, and Compaq's own documents show that.
Any other questions?
Just real quick, is this essentially the same suit pending in Oklahoma State Court? It's all that.
It's not the same suit, it's the same theories, different plaintiffs.
But other than the plaintiffs, it's essentially the same?
The same allegation.
Do you think this case meets the conflicts jurisdiction standards set out in Shine?
I do not, Your Honor, for the reasons that Your Honor stated. Either this is a B2 certification, in which case it's first impression, or it's not. They say it is.
The reason I ask that is we've been talking a lot about the merits, and I just haven't heard much about the conflict analysis.
Well, Your Honor, the...
I don't need you to restate everything. I just want to make sure that...
Yeah, no, we still believe that there is a lack of conflict jurisdiction for the reason we set out.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
Please, the court. I make 5 points. First, with respect to Monumental Life, which is a recent 2-1 decision by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. In that case, which was a discrimination case, the Fifth Circuit allowed an opt-out, even though it was a B2 class, and allowed damages. But I think it's also important to look at the rationale that the Fifth Circuit employed. The Fifth Circuit employed the rationale that what was happening in their case was closely akin to a Title VII civil rights case. Title VII allows back pay as a statutory remedy. And the Fifth Circuit was already on record, as other federal courts have been, of saying that in a Title VII discrimination-type case, where you have a statute that allows back pay, that Monumental Life is closely akin to that.
How is that different from a warranty that specifies three types of remedy?
Well, Your Honor, we don't have to guess, because the Fifth Circuit in the McManus case tells us that. In the McManus case, which was decided in the last few months as well, the Fifth Circuit specifically said that you cannot have that type of a class in an express warranty situation. And the reason that the court used is because when you're talking about an express warranty, which is the only allegation we have left against us, that you're talking about reliance. They said you cannot presume reliance class-wide. And in this particular case, one of the things they're saying we did wrong was we didn't meet the plans and specifications. There's no evidence in this case that any of these class representatives saw the plans and specifications. They didn't even read the warranty in this particular case. So the Fifth Circuit in McManus has clearly said that you cannot have a class certification in a breach of express warranty because the individual issues swamp, or overwhelm, I believe is the word the Fifth Circuit used, the common issues that may exist. The second point I want to make is they talk about how the trial court hasn't made any decision about opt-out. Your Honor, we think this flies in the face of what you said in Bernal. This idea of, well, let's certify it and worry about some of these issues on down the road is not appropriate under Texas law. If you look at the trial plan that the trial court adopted, I went back, he uses, it's a 46-page opinion. The judge didn't change one word from the order that was submitted and drafted by counsel here. He changed the month. And if you look at what the court said, he used the word alternately, or its equivalent, 22 times. Used the word likely 14 times. Used the word if this, if that, 34 times. He told us on page 7 of his trial plan that all of the material issues, both B2 and B4, were going to be tried together in one trial at the same time. On page 43, he says, well, I know I may try the B2 class first, and then I may try the other either before the same jury or a different jury. I'm not sure which. What we respectfully submit, with all deference to the trial court, is that the trial plan is not only fundamentally inconsistent, but it's vague and it's confusing.
Are you saying the B2 class would be different from the B4 class?
Yes, I think they are different. But let me put it this way. Every issue that we would try in a breach of warranty damage case subsumes every issue in the declaratory judgment case. And that's one of the reasons why you cannot have a declaratory judgment.
Why can't you have one in a case where, as is argued in this case, you've agreed that if the declaratory judgment goes against you, you're going to honor the warranty?
Well, that's not correct, Your Honor. The premise is that if they find a breach of warranty, and somehow if it's covered, that somehow we're just going to go in and do what they want us to do. But you've got to look at what is meant by breach of warranty. We're talking about notice. We're talking about the opportunity to cure the problem. We're talking about the reliance issue, so that you're looking at all of these issues. The bottom line is, in the corporate representative's testimony they rely upon, basically said, look, if our warranty covers it, the notice was within 1 year, the damage was incurred within 1 year, if all of the conditions precedent to the warranty are satisfied, you bet we'll stand behind it. But you can't just simply ask the question whether there's a warranty in this case and be entitled to a judgment. There are other issues, but if we try the damage case, assuming this court affirms the B4 class, if we try the damage, it subsumes every issue in the declaratory judgment action.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments in the case set for today. Submitted on the briefs and argument, the marshal is adjourned.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court.